Pleasure and joy to be with all of you, and I'd like to welcome you to our three-part teleclass, Love, Spirit, and You. In this class, we're going to be investigating some of the mysteries of the path of the heart, and our practice will be based on, in part, on a text from the yoga tradition, the Bhakti Sutras of Narada. Bhakti Sutras means aphorisms on the path of devotion. It'll be partly based on the Sufi teachings about the way of adoration or seeing the divine in everything. And it will also be based very much on the wisdom of our experience as travelers on the path of the heart. I'm Sally, and there are about 60 people in this class. Not all of you are here. Some of you are tuning in, of course, on the through the magic of the MP3. But all of us are, in the deepest way, present inside the space of the heart, the space of the collective we, the sangham, the community that we share here. Every one of us, certainly since birth, has been navigating the path of the heart. For some of us, it's been a relatively pain-free journey, easeful, enjoyable, pleasurable. For some of us, it's been like rock climbing. Most of us somewhere in between. And I suspect that every one of you, like me, has been one way or other, another, or at least on occasion, mauled, as Hafiz says, the great Sufi poet Hafiz, mauled by the paws of the divine rogue elephant of love. Because the path of love is a path not only of mystery, but also one that takes you through heartbreak as well as through incredible joy. And no matter how much or how long we've been on this journey, the truth is that none of us are experts on the path of love. One thing that I keep discovering again and again, whenever I think I've got it together, whenever I think I've got it figured out, whenever I think I'm sailing easily through the ocean of the heart, please forgive all the mixed metaphors, I discover that actually I'm a beginner again. Because even though love is the field we know most intimately, even though love, like spirit itself, is the core of us, it's also the most mysterious experience of life. So let's take this moment to become present to the shared communal space, the we space, the space of sangham, the place of community. In the path of love, classically in the path of love, it's often said that there are particular activities that are especially helpful. And you'll recognize them. I'm not going to give you the complete list now. But many of them are the familiar activities that are part of all popular religion and most spiritual communities. One of them is prayer. Another is service. Another is chanting. Another is telling stories that open the heart. But one that is part of every path is satsang, sangam, community, being with others on the path of love. Because when we are gathered with others, when we're actually inside a communal space, both the longing and the practice and the innate capacity that each one of us has individually is amplified by having it brought together. And as more and more people are beginning to recognize and explore these days, when a community, when a group of people are together, whether it's physically in the same space or in the etheric space that we occupy, our capacity for evolving together is magnified. It's one of the great mysteries. And the gift of community and the secret of community is simply willingness to be present. Willingness to just open up and recognize that we are actually all here together and that we are interacting with each other. Even if you're listening two or three days or a week or 3 weeks after this conversation has happened live, you're still part of the Sangha. Don't ask me how it works because I don't understand it. At least I don't understand it physically, though I suspect there's a law of physics that accounts for it. But on the mystical level, that presence that we share, once it has been opened up in the universe, remains present for us every time we tune into it. So let's start by becoming aware of our own heart. And the way I always like to do that is to breathe in through the center of the chest and just allow ourselves to be present to the energy inside the heart, which may feel very soft or might feel kind of opaque, but it doesn't really matter. Just by tuning into the heart space, you tune into yourself at a soul level, and you almost automatically tune into the others in the space. But to add to that sense of communion, you can also just become aware that there are others in this space, and that the hearts of the others are present just as our consciousnesses are present. So with your sense of awareness or presence or attention in the heart, now be aware of the flow of the breath. And I know for me, at the end of the day, or even in those moments when I've been outgoing and I let myself drop inside, this experience of tuning into the breath and letting myself be aware of the way the breath is flowing, endlessly flowing, flowing without my having to make it flow. What an enormous feeling of easefulness and relaxation becomes available as I surrender to the breath. So in our interaction, in our loving connection with each other, one of the places where we connect is through the heart space. Another place we connect is through the sense of breath as the ocean of spirit. In most of the ancient languages, the word for breath is the same as the word for spirit. Pneuma, the Greek word for breath, ruach in Hebrew, means both breath and spirit. And in Vedic India, the original word atma, which is the word that is usually used in modern Sanskrit as a synonym for self, for the spiritual core of the human being, one of its original meanings was breath. So all the words, all the ancient words for spirit are related to or identical with the words for breath. So right now, see if you can receive the breath with the feeling that the force that brings the breath in and out of your body is the love force of the universe. And recognize how even if you're feeling not so open, or if you're wrestling with a problem, or if you're physically uncomfortable, and by the way, if you're physically uncomfortable, hopefully you can set yourself or even lie down in a way that will let you be more comfortable. But even so, the breath is flowing in and out of your body, and it's flowing as the love flow of the universe, as Rumi says in one of my favorite lines of Coleman Barks' translation, "I've been forgetful every moment, but never has this flowing towards me slowed or stopped." So through the breath, we're experiencing the flow of love, the flow of spirit that runs through every particle of the known and unknown, the visible and invisible universe. So we let ourselves open to the flow of the breath. We let ourselves open to the felt sense of the heart energy. We let ourselves open to the presence of the others. the others who are here, who are with us. And we also let ourselves open to that subtlest level of presence, whose quality is awareness and love, awareness / love. That's the core of reality itself. And with that sense of connection to the heart, to the breath, and to each other, we'll chant the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave mantras, and then we'll recite the prayer asking that our practice be of benefit to all beings. And as we like to do in these audio classes, we'll chant with the grace of Krishna Das. Practice be of benefit to all beings, and that through the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that all beings be free of hatred, grasping, and dullness. And we ask to know the equality of all that lives. So again, with your awareness in the heart and with your awareness in the breath, listen to these words, which are from the Rig Veda. There was neither being nor non-being at that time. There was no region of air nor sky beyond it. What moved? Where? Under whose protection? Was there water, deep and unfathomable? There was neither death nor immortality then. There was no distinction between night and day. By its own inner power, the One breathed windless. Love yearning entered that One in the beginning. That was the first seed of thought. Searching within their hearts with wisdom, sages found the bond of being within non-being. And this one, through love, love has come to me from heart to heart, the thought of distant others. May that thought come to me here. So as the breath flows and you allow yourself to feel yourself being breathed by that one who breathed windless by its own inner power, and that is now breathing us, let yourself be aware, at least as a thought, that through love, love is coming to you now and now and now. So welcome again, and today we'll, of course, be going in and out of meditation. And I'm going to kind of set the frame of what we'll be talking about and what we'll be doing for the next couple of weeks. I also want to say something that I often say at the beginning of these classes, which is that there are a couple of ways to take the teleconferences. One is to listen to the class and, you know, just let it be something that you listen to. The other is to listen to the class and do the meditation homework, which I hope you'll all do. And the third is to listen to the class, do the meditation practice, and also work with some of the contemplations and exercises and queries that you'll be receiving. I also want to offer you, as we often do in these classes, the option of having a partner. And if you do want to have a partner, you can write in to Deb, and she'll set you up with somebody, hopefully in your time zone, but whom you can do some of the contemplative work with on the phone. And again, if you have the time and you've had the experience of having a partner on the teleclass, you know that it can be a big help and also a nice relationship. And of course, we'll also have a listserv, which on some teleclasses is very active, on others less so, but which is an opportunity for you to ask questions, which I'll answer, and also share and interface with each other, share your own wisdom and your experience. And also, if you have a question or something that you want to share that feels too personal for the web, for the listserv, you can send it to me, and I'll answer the question one-on-one. So love is both is and is not an emotion. Love is also probably, it's one of the words that we've been hearing and trying to understand and feeling and worrying because we weren't feeling most of our lives. So it's a very loaded word. And my own experience with approaching love frontally, which, by the way, we are going to do, is that very often when I've listened to a teacher approaching love frontally, you know, like talking about love, my initial experience has often been of unlove. I'm not sure why that is, but I just want to say that if that's happening to you, don't worry, because it's just a sign that the shell is breaking. Very often, as the shell over the heart or the armor around the heart begins to break, our first experience is of the armor itself. And often our second experience is of whatever emotions are present in the emotional heart, whatever the accustomed emotions are. So all of this is part of the experience of going deeper into love, spirit, and you. Love, spirit, and you. So love is both an emotion and not an emotion. And the reason I say that is because often when spiritual teachers talk about love, they start by saying that love is not an emotion. And of course, that's true because emotions come and go. But love in its essence is something that doesn't come and go. But it's also true that love is an emotion. And what I often feel about on this subject is that if love didn't include delight, enjoyment, juiciness, succulence, and drama, and pain, and devotion, and the heartfelt desire to help and serve, and you know, and all the other flavors of love, you know, which can include anger, sadness, jealousy, grief, in the path of the Bhakti Sutras, there's a way to work with all these emotions. But if love wasn't so filled with emotion, why would we seek it so intensely? Why would we value it so highly? As human beings, you know, as human beings partially enlightened and partially not enlightened, the emotion of love and the emotions around love are important. And of course, at the same time, love is not just an emotion. One of my friends, Mark Goffney, says love is a perception. One of my teachers, Guru Mai, used to speak very beautifully about how, for example, when you're bringing up children, you take care of them even when you're not feeling love for them. And especially on the spiritual path, of course, if love were just an emotion, then when we didn't feel that emotion, we wouldn't just feel dry, we'd actually be lifeless, because love is life itself. So what that means is that love is present whether or not we're feeling the emotion of love, because it's intrinsic to us. It's the essence of our being. We can never be without it, which, of course, for all of us non-dualists, that means that we don't have to seek it. We don't have to look for it, because we are never without it. Love is an energy. It's a profound force. It is what's breathing us. It's the force that's sometimes called, in some of the circles I move in, called the evolutionary impulse or the evolutionary urgency. In my tradition, the Shakti, the energy at the heart of life. And, of course, that force of life might manifest as the sexual urge, as the creative impulse, as, of course, the connection with another person or an animal or the deer who walks up to you on your lawn and whom you surprise in the act of eating your roses and who looks into your eyes with that absolute innocent love that can flow between fallen mammals. And love is also the capacity to care And it's our prana, above all. It's our breath, which means that when we feel that we're lacking in love or out of touch with love or sad, we can actually open up to an immediate attunement to love by feeling our way into the breath. And of course, the mystery of love is in the fact that it is not only the creative force. You know, the sages who intuited that love is the creativity of the universe didn't just intuit it because they saw the generative act going on between men and women. They intuited it because when you go very, very deep into a meditative state, when everything dissolves, when there is no you in that sense, what there is in the most miraculous and extraordinary way is this very, very deep love. This love that in the tradition of India is called bhakti. Love that is so primordial, so intense that it's got the power of what in some traditions they call the world tree. It's the root of life. And for that reason, the sage Abhinavagupta, the great philosopher of Kashmir Shaiva Tantra, said something that to me is one of the deepest recognitions there is. He said, that cosmic power, that power, that force of life, when it manifests in the cosmos, is called Shakti, or divine creative power. When it manifests in an individual, it's called Bhakti, or devotional love. Bhakti comes from a root which means to relish or to delight. And it's, you know, what he was saying is that our experience of love, whether it's love for God or all the different forms of human love, when our experience of love takes on that devotional feeling, then what we are experiencing is a direct connection to the universal power. And it's arguable, we could definitely argue that any form of love, no matter how weird or partial, is our connection to that primordial power. In the Western tradition, we call it eros, the feeling aspect of reality. And so love is reality itself. It's reality as feeling. And love is also a path. So that's where we're going to start today. The path of love, the path of bhakti, the path of the heart, is essentially, in its classical form, it's the spiritual tradition where we turn our capacity for affection towards the divine, towards the universal force, towards God, towards spirit itself. And all the paths which privilege love as a way to get to the heart of reality also include methodologies. One of the great points that the Bhakti Sutras by the sage Narada, which is, in a loose way, our text for these 3 weeks, one of the things he says is that love is both a methodology, that is, a means, it's also the goal. So in the devotional paths, Sufis and the mystical Christians like Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, and certainly the Hindu bhakti poets, the Hindu devotional poets, one of the things that they'll often say is that that the approach of the path of love is particularly sweet and enjoyable, especially compared to the more austere yogic approaches like hardcore hatha yoga. What they don't always say, however, is that the sweetness of bhakti, the sweetness of the path of love, is not necessarily something that you acquire through effort, even though most of us have to make effort in order to hold on to it. So, in other words, this capacity to relish reality, to take delight in spirit, is ultimately a gift. And one of the ways it comes is through transmission, through our contact with the hearts of those whose hearts are open, which is why hanging around with other devotees or other people whose hearts are willing to be moistened by love is such a significant way that we begin to kindle the love in ourselves. And yet, if you're longing for love, if you want love, if you feel that love is absent and you yearn for it, that yearning, that longing, that desire for love will always eventually open it up to you. This is one of the real paradoxes of spiritual life, that on the one hand, love, peace, awareness, whatever path you're on, whatever you call that sense of pure divine presence, it's not something you can acquire. It's not something you get through effort. And yet, paradoxically, effort and longing and yearning are pretty much prerequisites for a steady experience of it, except unless you happen to be one of those fortunate people whose lifetimes of spiritual practice have kind of landed you in this lifetime with a natural capacity for awakening and staying awake. Most of us have to practice, and so it's a very exhaustive set of practices and attitudes that help lead us to this state. And many of these practices, as I said earlier, are the basis of popular religion. And we're going to do some of them. Even they're practices that are at the heart of fundamentalist religion. And at the same time, they're the practices and the experiences of mystics. So what we could say is that what we do as practice when we're on the journey to love and spirit, to uncover love and spirit, becomes our experience at a certain point. And that's when we become mystics. And the other secret of this path, which we'll talk about later on, and especially in our contemplations of next week, is that this is a path in which our ordinary relationships, our emotions, even our negative emotions, are part of the path. There are a series of stories in the Indian devotional literature about beings who hated God. I mean, God in their avatar forms as Krishna and Rama. They literally hated God and fought God, and ultimately would be destroyed by God, as Ravana was by Rama, as Shishupala was by Krishna, for those of you who are familiar with the tradition. But what the texts say, what the mythology says, is that because of their one-pointed hatred, that one-pointed hatred directed towards the divine, their strong emotion actually brought them close and eventually allowed them to merge into the divine. So another of the secrets of the path of devotion is intensity. The more intensity you feel, if you can turn that intensity towards not necessarily a deity form of the divine, but if you can turn that intensity towards spirit in one of its guises, and we'll talk about this later also, then whether the intensity is positive or negative, it is going to uplift your state and take you into an experience of love, of the Shakti, the intense love at the heart of the universe. And, of course, the most accessible and the easiest way to begin to bring that experience forth in yourself is simply to recall the experience of love, of any kind of love, and let it fill your body. So we're going to do this, you know, at this moment, this very simple meditation practice, which happens to be a practice from the tantric text, the Vijnana Bhairava. So you can realize as we practice it that you're doing a very esoteric tantric text, even though it's unbelievably simple and in a certain sense obvious. So you begin by simply recalling a time in your life when you felt a lot of love. And it can be the moment when you first fell in love with your high school boyfriend. It can be a moment where your college girlfriend. It can be a moment with your mother or your father or your teacher or your child or a friend or a moment in nature. But find the moment that your mind turns to, that your heart turns to, when you can actually remember what it was like feeling love, sweet love, passionate love, that emotion that we call love. Where were you? How did it feel? To begin to kindle that feeling, you might bring the person to mind, that it might be someone that's very powerfully in your life right now, or someone from the past. Find yourself in that time, in that place. Find the memory. And when you feel a connection to love, let go of the person, of the place, and see if you can first just be present with the feeling, and without making too much effort, see if you can let that feeling spread through your body, through your heart, through your chest. See how much you can let that feeling encompass you or engulf you, not working too hard. But just letting yourself feel into that memory of love. As thoughts come up, just let them flow out with the breath. And as you very, very gently attune that yourself to that love feeling and let it spread, you can also be present to the breath arising and subsiding, to the breath flowing through you as the touch of love. See if you can keep part of your attention inside the sense feeling of love, of affection, of softness, of tenderness. Maybe the word love isn't a good word for you. So maybe the word is tenderness or acceptance or softness. One of the powerful practices that we can do and that I'm going to ask you to do during the week is to consider the times in your life and the people with whom that feeling of love has arisen spontaneously. I've noticed in my own life it very often happens with children, and I don't have children of my own, but it often happens with children I have no actual blood relationship to. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day who was telling me about this baby that he fell in love with. He's the child of a friend. And when the child was born, my friend just adored him. And he babysits for the child who's now two. And he says that whenever he sees the child, his heart melts completely. He's willing to do all kinds of, you know, boring and rather unpleasant tasks with utter delight, because being with the baby literally transfigures him. He feels saint-like and adoring when he's with this child. And one of the things he says is that when he's with the child, when he's in that feeling, there's a sense of presence that makes his life feel intrinsically worthwhile. You know, and he's a person who has ambitions, some of which have been fulfilled and some of which haven't, but it doesn't matter when he's with the child. So one of the characteristics of bhakti, of devotional love, is that when you feel it, it's enough. It's good in itself. You actually, in that moment, don't need anything else but that. And so this is one of the reasons why following the path of love can, in the natural course of things, give you the experience of a kind of melting away of your egoic self. The feeling of selflessness can just arise. So in the Bhakti Sutras, divine love or love of spirit is defined as love that has no need for anything except itself. In other words, it's defined as completely selfless love for the divine. And one of the things that I hope you're recognizing is that selfless love, that love that arises in the moments when you feel that kind of affection or warmth or tenderness, it always starts out as divine love. It's selfless. It's just an arising of this sweetness, of this affection. And if you had that experience during a contemplation, or if you can think back to times when you were just in love, and I know a lot of you here are very loving people and have had this experience often. Maybe you have it every day in meditation. You know what I mean. But what happens often in our encounters with love, and which is the reason why we have to do practice, is that it gets mixed up with our needs, our desires, our fears, our ambitions, all the baggage that, all the wounds that, that human beings bring with us into the world, either from our early childhood experience, which is even in the best situation going to include moments of, pain and abandonment, or from past life experiences where there is baggage that we don't even know we have. I often tell the story about the first time I ever felt divine love, so I beg your pardon if you've heard it. But I was 26, so sitting with my boyfriend, we'd taken a psychedelic drug. We were listening to the Grateful Dead and to this particular song that many of you know called Ripple, which is a song that has this line in it: "If I knew the way, I would take you home." And for some reason, at the sound of that, at those words, the entire universe exploded with this deep, deep, deep love, and with it, the awareness that love is all there is, love is all that matters, love is never absent, the whole amazing, exquisite download of divine love. And I turned to my boyfriend and I said, "Oh my God, there's so much love." And he said, "Haven't you ever taken acid before?" Now, I often tell this story it makes me laugh now, and it makes other people laugh, and it is kind of funny. Because it's kind of how life is. There you are with your wide open heart and your friend isn't in the same mood. But at the time, that experience was both a life-changing revelation and a total heartbreak. So the revelation, because I knew, and it was what really was a turning point in my life, that I wanted this feeling back, and that I was pretty much willing to give up the life I was living for the sake of it. But the heartbreak was just as deep, and it was because what I saw was that this guy I was with, whom I was in love with, was not going to be able to meet me in that field. In other words, he didn't get it, or the way I sorted it was he didn't love me. And because I was who I was at the time, that is a wounded 26-year-old who deeply believed that love, even when I was having an experience of love as everything, but that I really believed that love was something you could and were supposed to get from another person, the wound took over almost immediately. And it's something that I've seen over the years, both in myself and in other people, that along with our open hearts, side by side with our open hearts, are the wounds of love, which get triggered often right in the middle of the most exquisite experience. And so what arises as pure divine love, and love always arises as pure divine love, love with no object, presence, pure presence, takes on the coloration of your particular samskaric patterning, which skews towards whatever drama is your natural drama. And pretty, you know, when you get to know yourself, you pretty much know what your drama looks like. It's not ever different. You know, all that changes is your capacity to recognize that it's just the drama. But you know, whatever early childhood or past life impressions we're carrying, negative or positive, will distort and skew our experience of pure love. So again, you can often see that even when you're seized by this fullness of affection, there'll come this moment when your unadulterated experience, your ecstasy, your delight, your overwhelming desire to serve will get tinted by a tendency, and maybe you get manic with it. You know, you're just sort of over the top with it. I know people like that. Or maybe you go into unworthiness. Or maybe it's, as it is for so many of us, possessiveness. You want to keep it. Or wanting it to be completely special, just you and this other person, or just you and your special relationship with God or with your teacher. You know, or it could be fear. That you can't hold such a big feeling, or doubt that it's real, or defensiveness, or neediness. You know, there's so much there in the way of love. And so much a part of our practice of walking the path of love is learning how to hold the wound inside the love, or if not that, to be able to hold the wound in some kind of state of peacefulness, of sweetness, of witnessing. Because as we do, and this of course is the essence of spirituality, but in my experience, it's especially the essence of the path of love, that if you can hold the wound, you know, the neediness, the anger, the possessiveness, the doubt, the fear, whatever it is, inside the love, inside some kind of thread of the love, then, or, you know, whether you call it acceptance or allowing or presence, it doesn't really matter because those are all flavors of love. If you can hold the two together, then the presence, the love, will melt the samskaras, the pain, the wounds. And for some of us, that happens very quickly. For some of us, it's a lifelong process. But when push comes to shove, that is the essence of the path of love, that you can take those wounds, those emotions, those, you know, weirdnesses, and hold them inside your experience, your sense of love, which is itself divine, which is itself spirit, which is God. You know, that's the heart of the recognition of love, that any glimpse, any moment of love, whether you're experiencing it as great devotion or as presence or as a feeling of acceptance or of okayness or of allowing, allowing being a word that's very often used in the non-dual world these days, and which is a really actually a wonderful way of talking about love. It's okay, I'm just going to allow all of this. All of these subtle feeling states are flavors of love, and they all have the capacity to melt duality and melt your destructive tendencies. You just have to be willing to sit tight with them. So, again, you can close your eyes if you haven't already. And we're going to do a brief inquiry meditation. Ask yourself, what kind of love do I long for? What kind of love do I long for? And you may get words in answer to that question. You may get a feeling. But most of us have a kind of characteristic longing for a certain kind of love, unconditional. Constant, fun, we all have our own definition of what the very best kind of love would be. And maybe just in it, in asking that question, you may experience it, but sometimes you may not. So, this is the next question. Ask, is there love present? And then have the very concrete sense of actually opening your heart, like the shutter of a camera. Feel as though your heart opens like the shutter of a camera. And at the same time, feel that the crown of your head opens in the same way. You know how a camera shutter just kind of unfolds. And feel that love is pouring in through the aperture, the opening in your chest, in your heart center, and pouring in through the aperture in the crown of your head. You can feel it coming in with the breath, flowing in with the breath and then flowing through your body. And to augment that feeling and to give you a mantric focal point, if you like, you can have the thought, I am loved. I am loved. there something you'd like to write down, feel free to do it. And you can bring your attention more and more directly to the breath. Feel the breath coming in deep and flowing out on its own. And at this moment, I would like to invite any of you who have something that you'd like to share with us or something that you'd like to ask to unmute yourself by pressing star 7. And if you have the capacity to speak, and which sometimes one doesn't after meditation, and something that you would like to offer to us or to share with us from that practice, this is the moment when you can do it. Star 7. Hi, I hear you. I hear the sound of someone unmuting themselves.
Hi, Sally, it's Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about the Grateful Dead song that you brought up and the lyrics, because I know that song and I know those lyrics, and they have a similar effect on me. And I was kind of surprised when you said that. I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's my favorite part of that song. And so my question is, if you can address how music and words or like chanting and mantra are, you know, more than one person can recognize it as very potent, as opposed to some other words in music that isn't?
That's a really interesting question. And, first of all, I would say that a lot of what makes, first of all, music is directly more than you know, than verbal language, it's the language of the emotion. So the music itself goes right to your emotional body, right to your heart, which is, of course, why music is such a has such a profound effect on the atmosphere and on us. And I also would say that a lot of the power in a song like that comes from the voice. In other words, when the person who's singing or the person who's speaking is in a certain state themselves, then the vibration of their state is carried through the voice. The Grateful Dead and certain, you know, especially in that particular album, whoever it was that was singing, I think it was Bob Weir, was clearly in a heartfelt state that came through his voice. And the third thing I would say about those lyrics and the words of poetry that's very stirring, and you know, I think most of us can think of song lyrics or poems that many people are inspired by, first of all, I would say that in that case, that thought, you know, I would take you home if I could, you know, brings up the profound human desire to go home, you know, to be reunited with the source. So it's and the fact that, which is, you know, what that song is saying in other places, and the fact that you know, on this journey, even though someone else can take our hand, we essentially walk alone. So there's, you know, I would say that particular line for me, and I suspect for you and for many other people, because I've heard this from many people, brings up a really primordial longing. And if you think of poetry or music that's meant something to you, you know, there's music that constellates that profound longing. There's music that's literally stirring, you know, like I really love trumpet fanfares. You know, they inspire me, and I have them on my phone. All my ringtones are fanfares because there's something about that kind of stirring heart, you know, horn music that energizes and inspires. And I think many different composers and lyricists and poets are tapped in to this place of inspiration that touches people in a universal way. So I think it's part of the gift of the cosmos that the consciousness in you and the consciousness in me and the consciousness in, you know, thousands and perhaps millions of other people can be stirred by the same words. And as to mantra, we are actually going to talk about mantra next week. Mantra is a big subject. And mantra is very, very, as you know, important on the devotional path, because the combination of the sounds, of particular sounds, and also the freight of meaning and feeling that is invested in certain mantric sounds can literally not just open the heart, but initiate many, many people into profound spiritual states. That's part of what mantra is for, is for kindling the heart. So I hope that begins to answer your question.
Yes, thank you very much.
We'll take one other question, and then we're going to meditate. That's Karen.
Karen.
Yes.
Yes.
So Karen, can you remute yourself by pressing *6?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So I see another mic on. And
Gail.
Hi, Dale or Gail.
Yeah.
Hi.
So, I have a question. I was just feeling into, I love the inquiry we just did, and I was feeling into how often I'm seeking like a human love as a way to sort of soothe my nervous system from getting out of balance. It's like something related, I'm sure, to like parental stuff around self-regulation.
Right.
So I'm like seeking, you know, in my partner, like some sort of way of soothing my nervous system. And I find in those sorts of moments, that's never going to work because it's just not going to work. Like that's not what he's here for either, right? But anyway, I find that in those moments, it's the most difficult to kind of connect in with a divine love.
Yeah.
So it's not in other moments when I'm not feeling that sort of full nervous system trigger, then the connection is very immediate. In fact, it's not ever not there. So I'm just wondering about that difference, and I'm wondering if you had anything you could say about when you're really out of balance and you're really sort of, you know, your cat rubbed the wrong way, like all of your nervous
right.
system just wigged out. Then how do you sort of move into this divine love?
Really good question, and I think that what you're saying is something that we all recognize. I have to say you're right. It doesn't work because the thing you're longing for is something that probably, you know, goes back to early childhood and that unsoothed part of you is triggered and is going to be triggered until it's not. When it happens to me, I use a trick that I learned from a woman named, I think her name is Charlotte Castle. She's a psychotherapist. She says, and maybe it's not even original with her, that is, you just say to yourself, I'm triggered. And you say to your partner, I'm triggered. And there's something about that that activates the witness. And it actually can get you into a state of self-observation that, you know, where you're not expecting yourself to be soothable. You know,
you
know your partner's not going to soothe you, and he's probably triggered too because that's how it is often.
Yeah.
But it gives you a kind of time out. And I've actually found in close relationships where that happens, that when both people have the ability to say that to each other, you can chill for long enough to soothe it and sort of start again. I think that part of our humanness is that you know, we get out of balance and we get wounded and we have our weird responses, and you can't sort of. I mean, I've known enlightened beings who had those, at least beings who I thought were enlightened, who certainly seemed to be enlightened, who had those triggers. So, so it's good if you can just notice it, forgive yourself.
Yeah. And just remembering another thing that you said in another teleconference or telecourse that I think would go nicely with realizing that I'm triggered, and that is, when you were teaching about how just to kind of like feel all the particles that support you, like all of the, I think you were referring to it as anugraha, like just the whole grace that you're supported by. And just feeling into that and realizing that that would probably be another way, like that one is sort of the witness and the other is this sort of like embodied way of being held, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's beautiful. Thank you for remembering that, Gail. And actually just, So thank you for the question.
Thank you.
And thank you for your answer. So we're going to do a meditation that I'm going to ask you to do a couple of times this week. And I'm going to make an audio CD for you. And it's a visual meditation on finding the source inside, the being inside who is your, what in the Bhakti tradition they call your Ishta, your deity. And, you know, I want to say that the deity doesn't have to be a person. It can just be a feeling. For many of us, it is a feeling, but for some of us, it's also a person. And I'm going to call that person the guide. For some of you, it's natural to think of that person as the guru. For others, guru is a loaded word. So I'm going to call that person the guide. And I'd like you to just relax into a comfortable upright posture. And we're going to, I'm going to take you into the meditation, and then at some point in the course of it, we'll end the call, and I would suggest that you sit with it for a little while, and also, as I said, that you practice it a couple of times in the course of the week. So you want to make sure that your posture is grounded and feel the base sinking into the seat or the floor. If you want to lie down, that's okay too. But as you do, you want to make sure, of course, that your spine is upright, that you feel the energy flow moving up from the base up through the crown. The shoulder blades release onto the back, and the chest lifts and opens. And with the breath, you become aware of how the energy of love, the energy of grace, is flowing in with the breath. Flowing in and flowing out in a very natural way. And your attention naturally centers itself on the breath. And you imagine yourself now, even if possible, feel yourself seated where you're seated. But feel that your subtle body, a portion of yourself, a kind of dream body, arises from your physical body and finds itself in front of a gate, a door through the wall of the room you're in. And when you open the door, you find yourself on a path. And you look down and you see what the path is made of. Perhaps it's a mossy forest path. Perhaps it's very formal. Perhaps it's a trail. And as you walk along the path, you notice the trees around you. And you notice that the time of day is that magical time between sunset and moonrise, that liminal time, that time that has been called the crack between the worlds, the junction point. And as you walk with the luminosity of twilight around you, you find yourself in a clearing. And you see that in the clearing, there's a small temple. Just notice what it looks like. You walk up a few steps to the porch of the temple. You see that outside the temple there is a basin and with water in it, and you're guided, you're called to take water in your hand and sprinkle it over your head. And then you walk in through the door of the temple. And you see that there is a kind of altar, a seat. And that in that place, perhaps in a physical form or perhaps in an invisible form, is the being who is your guide, your ancient guide. The form of the divine lover, of the inner self, of spirit itself, that you have loved, whether consciously or unconsciously. For lifetimes. You may see the form in the face, or you may not. It may keep changing. And as you move closer, you may become aware that this inner guide, this form of the beloved, has taken many different forms for you over the years in this life or in other lives. But see if you can have the recognition or the understanding that this being has the deepest possible knowledge of you, of your journey. And enormous unconditional love for you. This is the form that your inner self has taken to guide you. This is the perhaps embodied, perhaps not so clearly embodied, face of spirit, the true face of spirit. And at this moment, you may just feel that you want to sit in meditation with a sense of presence. Or you want to ask a question. And the question might be something like, is there something I need to understand or to know? Is there something about my journey I need to know? Is there something about myself that you can tell me? Or it may be a question about someone in your life. And it's also completely fine if there is no question. And if an answer arises, whether from within you or seeming to come from this being, allow yourself to listen to it, to take it in. And with the inhalation, with the next inhalation, or whenever you're ready, have the feeling that the guide, the beloved, enters you with the breath and takes seat inside you, which is, of course, where that being has been seated all along. And recognize that just as you're supported from the universe by the life force of love, so you are supported on your journey from within by the beloved, the guide, who is the unique and personal form of your soul's beloved, who has taken so many forms to guide you and challenge you for so many lifetimes. And in that recognition, just let yourself sit with wonder and appreciation for the mystery of the journey of love that you've taken. And with love, I'll say goodnight. Sit for a while if you can. Have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week. Let us know what's going on with you. And your homework will be arriving. So much love. Namaste.